Her name is Tracy Dowdy. She's consulted with over 100 practices nationwide, is a certified veterinary practice manager, and she serves on the board of directors for the AVPMCA. She's been published in a local and national veterinary journal, as well as being a contributing author of Management Basics for Veterinarians and has spoken at local, regional, and national veterinary meetings.
Okay, how's that? Good morning. How's everyone doing? Is that better? Okay. Well, I came across the Hyatt and walked over this morning, and I just wanted to stay outside. It just felt so wonderful. I'm from Dallas, but I don't know. There's something about Colorado weather that just makes me want to be outdoors. So did you guys experience the same thing on your way over here? It was just absolutely beautiful. I am very, very excited to talk to you today about creating, helping you develop a vision for your practice. We're going to talk about this client-patient-centered practice model. And I believe that in order to implement change in your practice, you've got to have a reason behind why you're changing. Otherwise, it's difficult to get your team on board with the changes that you want to be able to implement in your practice. So if you have a vision of where you're going and you can get your team excited and committed and they can share and contribute to the vision, then you're going to be able to be more likely to get them to do some of the changes and be part of the implementation process. And so what I hope to give you today over the next 50 minutes is some concepts of what your vision could look like in your practice. I think that we do not give change enough credit, and I think that if you are experiencing any sort of change in your practice or you're trying to implement change, people go through different phases when they're experiencing change in their current roles and responsibilities. And I believe that's why it's so important to have a clear, defined vision of where you're going. Typically, when you start implementing change, the first reaction to your team is denial. They'll say, yeah, this too shall pass. We're not really changing. I've been here, and we've heard this before, been there, done that. We're not going to change, and I don't believe we're changing. And these folks just pretend that it's not going to happen, and they just deny that we're going to change. And then once you start to continually focus on the change and implement change and force the change, then they start to get angry. Why are we changing? I don't want to change. I like things the way they are. We've always done it this way, and this is the way I like it, and I'm mad that we're changing. Why are we changing? And then once you start to continually focus on the change and implement it, then they start bargaining. Well, I'll change some, but I'm not going to change everything. I'm just going to change the things I like, and the things I don't like, I'm not going to change. And these folks start sabotaging the success of the change that you're trying to implement in the practice. And then hopefully they start to move out of bargaining and into depression. And you might see their performance go down, their attitude may not be as positive as it once was, they start feeling sad and insecure about what part they play in the changes that you're implementing in their current roles and responsibilities. And then hopefully they will reach a point of acceptance. And that's when exhilaration kicks in and they start to get excited about the changes that you're implementing in the practice. Now, all of us are raised in different families. We all have different personality styles. We have different baggage in our life. And we all experience change and approach change differently. Some of you may race straight to acceptance. You love change. You embrace change. You like change. Where there may be other people in your practice who hate change. They despise change. They like things consistent. And they camp out in denial, or they camp out in anger. And I think what it's, as leaders and as managers, we need to understand that going through these phases is normal. What's not normal is for people to just get stuck in denial or get stuck in anger. And so one of the things I do when I work with practices and we are implementing a lot of change, because that's basically what I am, I'm a change leader. I go into practices and make recommendations on how they can change for the better. We spend some time talking about change and how people experience change. So I would suggest if you're going to develop a vision or you're going to implement a lot of new concepts or systems in your practice, you need to spend some time with your team talking about how people go through the different phases of change. And I believe that's why it's so important that you have a clear, defined vision of where you're going, because it'll be easier for you to get people to buy in and reach a point of acceptance. So what is the vision for your future? When I talk about a vision, I'm not talking about a fancy mission statement that we're going to mat and frame and place in our reception area on the wall for clients to see. It's not going to be about our high quality care and our excellent client service. That's typically your purpose. That's your purpose in your practice. Your vision is your future state. Are you cognizant of what you are working towards to improve your practice for the future? And is your team on board with that? Are you doing some sort of strategic planning with your team every year where you sit down and you say, let's brainstorm together and let's talk about how we want to improve our practice over the next 12 to 24 months? If you're grossing over $1 million in your veterinary practice and you're not doing that, you're really leading to catastrophe. You need to be planning for your future. Our world is all about change. Our profession has changed dramatically over the last 20 years. And so you need to be proactive in regard to what does the future state of your practice look like. Now, this is one of my clients that I've worked with, Friendship Hospital for Animals. They are a 24-hour facility in Washington, D.C. They're open 7 days a week, 365 days a year. 24 hours a day. They have over 100 employees, 20 veterinarians. They have some specialists. And they didn't really have a vision in place that their team shared in and bought into. And so we came together as an entire healthcare team, the 120 or so employees. We rented out a ballroom at a hotel at a Marriott, and they developed some core values and some vision statements. And I want to share those with you just to kind of help you grasp this vision that I'm talking about. Their core values are equality, compassion, loyalty, respect, commitment, fun, honesty, teamwork, and personal responsibility. And these core values were very meaningful to them because these were things that they did not currently have in place that they realized they needed to document and put in black and white so that they could start working towards when they made decisions, they funneled up to these core values. And then they developed these vision statements, and these are listed in the proceedings. Those of you, if you want to write them, you're welcome to, but they are listed in the proceedings. But these were the vision statements that they developed, and everyone on the team publicly committed to these vision statements. And so this becomes the measuring stick to the changes that they make in their practice. We want to share the knowledge with the entire healthcare team to fully meet the needs of our clients and patients. We want to set and maintain high service standards and hold individuals accountable to those standards. We want to foster an environment of loyalty, respect, and equality. And we want to recognize and celebrate the diversity among our clients and our staff. We're committed to providing excellent care to our patients, our clients, and each other 24 hours a day. We're committed to open and honest communication. We want every team member to be committed to a clear, shared vision of our future. So that means that if people couldn't get to the point of acceptance, they weren't going to be on the team any longer, because they wanted everyone on the team to be committed to the journey that they were taking, and they wanted everyone to get on the bus and take that journey with them. Otherwise, they really didn't belong on the team. They're committed to providing compassionate care to their clients and their pets. They strive to be the national leader in veterinary health care, and they value training to promote education and growth. And now, like I said earlier, this becomes the measuring stick that they're implementing in their practice. So when they have a team member who is in denial or who's angry about a change that they're making in their practice, they can go back to that person and say, well, Susie, does this decision or this new system or this new standard or this new process that we're implementing, does it funnel up to our vision statement? And Susie can take a look at that, and if the answer is yes, well, then we're making the right decision. We need to be implementing this new thing. And so you get a greater point of acceptance with your healthcare team when they see the bigger picture of where we're going and why we're going there. So with that in mind, let's kind of go back to the very beginning of our profession, and let's look at the history of our profession, and let's talk about where we were and where we are now and where we need to go in the future. So I have a question I want to pose to you. Why were veterinary schools first created? What was the purpose? Anybody? Trained veterinarians to do what? What type of animals did they work on? Yeah, Iowa State was the first veterinary school that was created because their livestock was more valuable than their land. And over 20 veterinary schools closed down when what was invented? The automobile. Over 20 veterinary schools were closed down when the automobile was invented. So why do I bring this up? I bring it up because our profession has this utilitarian, agrarian backdrop where it focused on livestock and animal food production and horses for transportation. And if this cow right here is worth $500 and it's ill and it needs veterinary care, how much is the farmer going to pay to have that cow cared for? Probably under $500, right? Because it has a monetary value, and that's all the value that this cow has to that farmer. So it's a money proposition. And do you think this cow received dental care and high maintenance food and healthy pet profiles and that sort of thing? No, minimal care. And that culture still permeates today in our profession. And I'm going to talk about that throughout this session, but that culture and that backdrop of where our profession comes from still permeates today. There's statistics that show that our profession has not caught up with the bond that people have with their pets today. And I believe it's because of where our profession comes from. One of the things that Emily did not mention to you is that I'm a daughter of a veterinarian. My father is 62, and he's been practicing for over 30 years, and he kind of has that old school mentality. He's come a long way. He's made a lot of paradigm shifts. When I came on board with him and helped him with his practice, you know, he had a lot of this mentality with the way he practiced medicine back in the early 90s, and he's had to really make some changes, some transformation in the way he saw pets, the way he saw clients, the way he practiced medicine. But sometimes it still permeates in practices that I go into and I consult, and I'm going to talk more about that as we move on. So here's Ashley and here's Sarah. Which one's Ashley and which one's Sarah? Isn't it interesting how we're humanizing pets by giving them human names? Ashley's the little girl and Sarah is the dog. And Ashley is staying with friends for summer vacation that own Sarah. And now she went back home after her visit, and Sarah has been licking her paws constantly since Ashley left, and now they're starting to bleed. What's wrong with Sarah? She's what? She's lonely. She's bored. Maybe she has separation anxiety. How much separation anxiety training do you think veterinarians got 20 years ago in vet school? Zero, because I've asked many veterinarians. And they tell me I didn't get any separation anxiety training, any behavioral training. So we've got some demanding changes in our profession because of this human-animal bond. How many of you read the article that was in the Trends magazine last month? It was the author's name leaves me at the moment, but he was the CEO of the Starbucks organization. And had all those statistics in there about our profession. And I believe they said that $43 billion a year is spent on animal care annually. And even after September 11th, many industries went into a recession and lost income, but not the veterinary profession. We have continually grown year after year after year. 89% of pet owners see their pets as a family member. 80 to 90% of pet owners see their pets as children. 89% of pet owners believe their pets understand all or some of what they say. You believe that? I believe it. I believe it. I have two bloodhounds at home right now, and Red and Blue are their names. And normally they board at my father's practice when I travel, but it's spring break right now. So I called right before I was coming to Denver, and I said, I need to bring Red and Blue in. They said, sorry, there's no space for Red and Blue. So I had a friend come over to take care of Red and Blue for me, and he comes over, and I said, you know, they stay in their crates. And he says, well, how do I get them in their crates? How do I tell them, you know, how do they get up in there? And I said, well, you just tell them, go get in your house. And he goes, they'll go? And I said, yes, they'll go. He said, okay. And so then I showed him, you know, when you, and then they had space for the dogs yesterday. So Thursday and Friday they stayed at home, and then Saturday they got taken to the kennel. So I showed him, you know, just put them in the truck. And he goes, well, how do I get them in the truck? And I said, just tell them, get in the truck. And he said, I tell them to get in the truck and they'll get in there? And I said, yeah, they'll get in. So he calls me yesterday. He goes, man, these dogs are better than children. He said, they did it exactly like you said. I said, go get in your house. And he goes, man, they just raced up the stairs and went into their crates, and it just was no problem. Then I told him, get in the truck. And he goes, they got in the truck just like you said. 48% of pet owners say they are emotionally dependent upon their pets. Do you believe it? I believe it. Absolutely. I don't know if any of you attended this symposium. It was several years ago, but it was at Western Veterinary Conference. It was entitled Pets as Prescriptions, and the keynote speaker was the chief medical director of the Mayo Clinic. And he got up and said that he prescribes pets to 30% of his patients. And this was a day-long symposium that had psychiatrists, psychologists, researchers, medical doctors that have done all this research that shows people who have pets live longer, they go to the doctor less, they take less medications, and they have happier, healthier lives because of that pet in their life. There was one specific research that had been done on 40 single stockbrokers that all had high blood pressure. Imagine that. And they had them go out and either adopt a puppy or a kitten, and then they monitored their blood pressure. And within 6 months, the majority of them either got off their blood pressure medication or their blood pressure medication was reduced as a result of having that puppy or kitten in their home with them. So there's this healing power of pets, and we as a veterinary profession have to be the pet advocate. We have a lot to do when the pet owners come into our practices, and we have to educate them and talk to them about the needs of their pets. Now, this is my daughter, Haley. And this is her little kitty, Mushi. Mushi is an Oriental Siamese, and I actually got Mushi from a client that I was consulting in Savannah, Georgia, back in 1999. It was a husband and wife team, and the wife breeds Oriental Siamese, and she was taking me around the practice and showing me around, and we get to this cage of all these little Siamese cats bouncing around in this cage, and I said, oh, those kitties are so cute. I would never own one because I think Siamese can be somewhat schizophrenic. But I thought they were beautiful cats, and I was commenting about how beautiful they were. And she said, oh, please take one. I wasn't planning on having this litter. You know, I normally sell these cats for $250, $300, but I will just give him to you because I know you'll give him a good home. And I said, no, thank you. I appreciate that. But, you know, we have pets already, and, you know, I really don't think so. And to make a long story short, I come home with this kitten. And he immediately just took to my daughter. I mean, he is my daughter's best friend. Haley is his master. And he absolutely loves Haley. Now, a few months ago, Haley walked by my office and she saw me. I was working on this PowerPoint presentation and she said, Mom, I can't believe you're using that picture. That picture is so old. And I said, well, babe, it's the only picture I have of you with Mushi, and I like it, and I use it to talk about you. And she goes into her bedroom with her digital camera, and she takes these pictures. She'll be 13 next month, and Mushi is still very much a part of her life. This cat goes anywhere. She goes everywhere she goes. He sleeps with her. If you want to find Mushi, he's laying on her bed. Most of the time, he sleeps with her every night. So let me ask you a question. How much money do you think I'm going to spend on Mushi to keep him part of Haley's life? I mean, he cost me nothing. Absolutely. There's just a tremendous relationship that they have together. And I'm going to do whatever it takes to keep him part of Haley's life. We have these demanding changes in our profession. And what I hope to give you guys a clear understanding is that I don't want to give you ideas on how to make your bicycle go faster. Because you're probably pedaling as fast as you possibly can right now in your practice. What I want to do is help you build a car. Because when you drive a car, there's a lot of amenities to driving a car. You just have to push on the accelerator. You don't have to pedal like crazy to get from point A to point B. There's more passengers on board, and there's a lot of amenities of driving a car. Here's the typical production of today's veterinary practice, and this was the AVMA study several years ago. And I'm not sure if it's been updated. I would say this is low compared to most of the practices that I go in and consult, but I think it's average across the country. The daily transactions per veterinarian are 10 to 15 transactions per day. Clients that most veterinarians are seeing on an annual basis, 1,000 to 1,500 clients. And the annual sales per veterinarian is $250,000. And I think that's extremely low. Would you guys agree? But what I hope to do is give you guys a vision of transforming your practice where you can produce at atypical levels of growth and production. You can increase your average transaction charge, increase your number of transactions, increase the number of clients you see on a daily basis. Now, this is my dad's practice, Advanced Animal Care Center. It's a two-doctor practice. It's generating $1.5 million with 20 support staff. Who do you think is generating all of that income in the practice? The support staff is really helping to make that practice generate that sort of income. This practice has a healthcare team that is highly knowledgeable. They have exceptional client service skills. They're highly leveraged. They're utilized to their fullest potential, and the veterinarians in this practice do what they were licensed to do, and that's practice veterinary medicine. One of the things I do when I go into practice is I do confidential interviews with the healthcare team. And one of the questions I ask the team members is, does this practice provide exceptional client service? And many times the healthcare team member will say, yes, we provide exceptional client service. And then I'll ask them, give me an example of something you do that's exceptional with your clients. And many times the answer they give me is, well, we provide excellent patient care. Our doctors are excellent veterinarians, and the care that we give the pets is exceptional. Do you think the average pet owner knows what high-quality medicine looks like? They really don't. I mean, I think pet owners are becoming more and more savvy of excellent medicine, but really, they translated into, was the receptionist polite and friendly when I called on the phone to make an appointment? Did I have to wait very long to get into an exam room to see the doctor? Was the facility clean and odor-free? Did I get all of my questions answered? Did I know what the bill was going to be at the time when I went to pay it? Those are the things that people translate into medicine. And now clients are demanding both. So in a 20-minute exam visit, here's everything that you need to discuss with your clients. And the list just continues to grow. But you have to talk about medical history, examination findings, vaccinations, parasites, dental care, lab tests, flea control, heartworms, benefits of blood work, nutrition, behavioral issues, fecal exams, spay and neutering, wellness care, release instructions, prescription medications. And it just goes on and on and on. Can all of this be done with this one person in the center? It's virtually impossible. But you know what? I go into practices, and the current veterinary delivery system limits our capacity to serve our clients the way we need to service them. What's missing in this picture? Support staff. And I've been in practices all over the country, and many don't even utilize their healthcare team in the exam rooms. Technicians aren't even allowed in the exam room. The doctor goes in and does everything. And if someone does come in the room, they are not allowed to communicate with the clients. And so the veterinarian becomes the rate-limiting step to practice growth. The veterinarian becomes the bottleneck in the workflow because they feel that they need to do everything that goes on in the practice. I'll just give you an example of what I'm talking about here. Here's the veterinarian who has a brain. They went to school for 8 years to learn how to practice veterinary medicine, and now they have this tremendous amount of knowledge and skills. And now they have to educate clients, because the pet owner is unaware, and we have to make them aware so that they'll have understanding and they will be convicted to take action. Now you have a happy client, happy pet, and there's this strong doctor-client relationship. Do you have any clients in your practice that are just adamant about seeing your doctor? They don't want to talk to anybody else. They just want to see Dr. Jones or whatever your doctor's name is. They feel like they're the only one that can answer their questions and solve their problems. Well, many times it's because they've shared their knowledge and skills with that client. They've developed a relationship with that client because they've educated them, they've met their needs, and now there's this bond between the doctor and the client. And it's through this process. Hopefully there was good client service, there was a positive case outcome, the client paid their bill. Now there's job and personal satisfaction that motivates this veterinarian to do it all over again. And what needs to happen in veterinary practices is we've got to bring the healthcare team in this loop and let the healthcare team educate clients. And on a scale of 0 to 100%, how many of the animals that come into your practice are for these things? Physical exam, vaccinations, heartworm testing, fecal testing, feline leukemia, FIV testing, spay, neuter, declaw, dentistry, common maladies such as eye infections, ear infections, skin problems, lameness, vomiting, and diarrhea. On a scale of 0 to 100%, how many of the animals that come into your practice are for those things I just mentioned? 90%? And I talked about this yesterday, those of you who were in, maybe heard me yesterday. So 85 to 90%, and I go into practices and I ask this question and they tell me 85 to 90%. If you work in a general practice, if you're critical care or emergency, things are, you know, much more technical, obviously. But in general practices, most of the pets that walk into your practice are healthy and are getting routine services. And your healthcare team can talk to clients about those things. But we don't share our knowledge with them. We don't empower them to talk to clients and educate clients. How many of you guys are familiar with the AHA compliance study that came out several years ago? Those of you who are not familiar with it, there was a compliance study that came out that clients want to be informed. They want to be educated. They want to be called and called and called and reminded of the services that their pets need. And then they also surveyed that when they asked veterinarians and their staff members, do you believe your clients are complying with your recommendations regarding some routine services? They said, oh, yes, they're complying really well. And when they actually went in and surveyed the medical records, they were off. They were off substantially for heartworm preventative, blood work, pre-anesthetic blood work, dentistry. And I think it's because we are underutilizing the healthcare team to educate clients like they need to be educated so that they will comply with our recommendations. Staff empowerment has to happen. But you know what? In order for the veterinarian to trust that the healthcare team can communicate as well as they can communicate, you have to train your healthcare team. You have to spend the time training them and developing them to a place where you can trust that they're going to communicate it. They're going to be able to communicate conversational veterinary medicine just like the veterinarian does. And I think that's the rate-limiting step to getting there. But this is the traditional model. This was my father's practice when I came on board. It was a very doctor-centered environment. He had been practicing for almost 20 years, and he was ready to leave the profession. He was so burned out and so tired because he was in the center of everything that was going on in his practice. All the client relationships were with him. All the diagnostic and treatment procedures he was recommending and to clients, and and overseeing all the staff management he was doing, all the practice management, all the pet care, all the client education. And he was tired. He was tired of running a business full-time and being a full-time veterinarian and a full-time manager. It was extremely difficult to get every task accomplished on a daily basis and have a great attitude doing it. But I go into practices, and this is what I see many times, is that veterinarians are tired because they're trying to do it all. And what has to happen is the veterinarian's got to get out of the center of their practice and put the client and the patient in the center of the practice. But what happens is the veterinarian becomes the rate-limiting step to practice growth. Client communication is inconsistent across the team. How many of you have multiple doctors in your practice? Almost the majority of you. Now, is there inconsistency in what the veterinarians are doing in your practices? And it's frustrating for the staff because they're trying to communicate with clients, but they don't know what to say. Well, if you see Dr. Jones, he may recommend this. If you see Dr. Smith, she may recommend this. So I don't really know what to tell you, Mrs. Client. And there's confusion about how to educate clients because there's inconsistency in what the doctors are doing and what they're recommending to clients. And it's harder to provide good client service when there's inconsistency in what's being communicated. It's harder to provide good, it's harder to have good profits when you have inconsistency. The healthcare team, they consider their work a job and not a career many times in these doctor center practices because they're not being challenged. They're not growing. They don't have the knowledge. They're just being told what to do on a daily basis, and they do it, but they're not able to be empowered to solve people's problems. And guys, that's what we're in the business of doing. You know, animals do not walk in the door by themselves. They walk in the door with humans and pet owners that have problems, and it's our job to solve those problems. We are in the people business, and we many times underutilize our healthcare team to help our clients because we don't give them the empowerment or the knowledge to be able to do it. And that's why you have turnover so often in veterinary practices. And so what I hope to help you cast a vision for your healthcare team is creating a client patient-centered practice where everything we do in our practice funnels up to how we can better serve our clients and our patients. We get the veterinarians, and it may not just be veterinarians. Maybe it's a subset of people in your hospital that have so much knowledge, but it's not shared amongst everyone. I mean, I've been in practices where, you know, we have key technicians. We've got a practice manager, we've got doctors, and they hoard all the knowledge. And then you've got a subset of team members who have no knowledge at all. And they're just doing menial tasks. So we want to get those folks out of the center of the business. And we want to develop standards in our practice that everyone is trained to. Everyone knows what the standards are. Our standards of care, our standards of service, our standards of communication, our standards of image, our standards of conduct. And now the veterinarian is just a spoke in the wheel, and the healthcare team is an equal spoke. And we are all, ladies and gentlemen, serving our clients in its highest form. We all have the knowledge so that we can solve our clients' problems, we can meet our patients' needs, and we can practice medicine in its highest form and provide exceptional client service. Everyone is trained to how we can better serve our clients and our patients. The way we schedule our appointments, our hours of operations, funnels up to how we can better serve our clients and our patients. So in client-patient-centered practices, veterinarians get to do what they were licensed to do, and the healthcare team is empowered to develop relationships with clients. If you've got a motivation problem in your team, you have a team that's not motivated, they don't seem like they really want to come to work and do a great job, it may be because they don't feel like they're doing something that inspires them. You want to inspire your team, start empowering them to have relationships with clients, and they're able to solve clients' problems. You will incredibly motivate your people. In client-patient-centered practices, there's consistency in what's being provided because there's a standard by which everyone is trained to in your practice. Revenues and profits are higher. Training and empowerment, what does it do to the team? Well, they start to feel happy and confident about their contribution to the practice because they realize that they're helping the practice generate income. Michael Gerber wrote the book, The E-Myth Revisited, Why Most Small Businesses Fail and What to Do About It. The E stands for entrepreneur. He says that people decide to go into business for themselves and they have what's called an entrepreneurial seizure. He said in order to really have a successful business, you need to have three qualities in you. You need to be a good manager. You need to be a good entrepreneur and visionary. And you need to be a good technician. And the technician revolves around the skill set or expertise to run that business, i.e. a veterinarian. But many times, people have the technical side of it. They're the technician, and they say, you know what? I can do this better than my boss. I want to be my own boss. I want to do my own thing. I want to have my own rules. I'm going to go start my own business. And Michael Gerber calls that having an entrepreneurial seizure. Because many times they don't have all of the qualities that they need to really run a business successfully. But he talks about in this book about how to start off your practice with a mature vision of where you want to go. And he talks about having a systems-dependent organization where you have a system for everything you do in your business. And I believe that's what veterinary practices need. When you have a systems-dependent organization, then the owner of the business can get out of the middle of the business and can walk away and be a true business owner because the business still operates, because it has a system for everything you do. And people understand that system. And when you have a systems-dependent organization, it can be operated by people with the lowest possible skill level. I mean, look at McDonald's, for example. McDonald's is an extremely successful conglomerate. And I can say from experience that it's not because they make exceptional hamburgers and french fries. Right? The fries sometimes you do crave the fries, but it's the consistency in what's being provided at McDonald's. I believe that's what makes McDonald's so successful. You can go to Seattle, London, Dallas, and when you walk into those golden arches, you're going to get that same quarter pounder with cheese, the same french fries, the same chocolate shake. And people, you know, I started off this presentation with change, how much we hate change. People do not like change. So we pay for consistency. If you go to a place of business and you get good service, and then you go back the next time and the service is still good but drastically different, the experience is drastically different than the first visit, you're probably going to walk away and say, that wasn't as good as it was the first time because it was different. People do not like having different experiences every time they come into your practice. Have you had your clients comment about the turnover at your front desk and comment that they didn't like, you know, what happened to, you know, Kim, she knew me. Where did she go? People like consistency. And when you develop a systems-dependent practice, your clients will be providing a better service to them. Impeccable order through standards and core values. The standard will provide uniform and predictable service to your clients. It becomes the guide. This is how we do it here in our hospital. Versus when you train your new employees, one of your employees says to that new employee, well, this is how I do it. This is how I clean a cage. Or this is how I answer the phone. Or this is how I check a client in. But you can do it however you want. And this is, you know, not everybody does it the same. And so there's inconsistency in what's being provided. The doctors are practicing medicine differently. They're making different recommendations. Can you see how hard that would be to provide exceptional service and empower your healthcare team when there's just such variety in the way we do things in our practice? So you have to spend time working on your practice versus in your practice. Michael Gerber talks about the fact that we don't spend time making our practice and our businesses what we want them to be, working on our vision. If you want to create a vision with your healthcare team, develop a vision like that vision I showed you earlier, you've got to spend time on a weekly basis making that vision become reality. Otherwise, you're just wasting your time developing those core values, developing those vision statements, and then just pushing them to the side and putting them on a shelf so they can collect dust. It's pointless to even have strategic planning. You've got to spend time with your team working on your practice versus in your practice. And many times we don't do that with our healthcare team. One of the things that I recommend with my clients is weekly meetings. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about weekly meetings at the end of the day and how to have effective weekly meetings. And I talked about this yesterday, those of you who listened to me yesterday speak. But I've seen such success in meeting with your people every single week. I mean, think about how many hours a week your practice is open on a weekly basis. 65, 70 hours a week, 75 hours a week. You can dedicate 2 to 3 hours a week with your entire healthcare team working on your practice, implementing your vision, working on your future state. But many times we get so wrapped up in just working in our business, you know, going through the motions of the day to day, and you realize that you're never going to get things implemented. I hear that often. Well, you know, we have good intentions, we have all these great ideas, but it just never happens. We never get anything implemented. And it's because you don't take the time to work on your practice as an entire healthcare team. I hear often in practices that I consult the communication. We have poor communication in our practice. There's gaps in communication. Our staff, there's low morale in our healthcare team. People are not being held accountable for the work they do and their attitude and their actions in the practice. There is a lack of a clear direction of where we're going. We don't have any goals set with our team. And weekly meetings creates a forum where you're going to be able to talk about those things. You're going to be able to open up the lines of communication with your healthcare team. I mean, think about all the things that go on a weekly basis in your practice that you never resolve and you never address because you don't take the time to meet with your healthcare team on a weekly basis to go over those things. How many of you have weekly meetings right now? Raise your hand. Okay, maybe a fourth of you. It's excellent. It's excellent. I'm going to talk a little bit later in the day about how to structure that and how to create an agenda for that so that your team will run to these meetings and they will be excited about these meetings. I hear many times they say, well, you know, I'm just afraid to have meetings with my team because it just always turns into a negative gripe session. It does not have to be that way. It's about having a structured agenda and having a good facilitator in place where people are learning and they're feeling challenged in their work. When people are challenged and they're growing and they're learning how to do their job better, they're going to be motivated. So if your meeting is focused on serving your clients, serving your patients, developing your healthcare team, growing them and challenging them, sharing your knowledge with them, taking the knowledge out of the veterinarian's brain and putting it into your client care specialist, your veterinary assistants, your technicians, your kennel assistants, your grooming staff, now everyone has the same knowledge and a consistent message that they're presenting to your clients. You're going to increase your capacity to grow. You're going to increase your number of transactions. You're going to increase your gross income, your net profits. But we just don't do that. And it needs to happen. Questions? How are we doing on time, Emily? 5 minutes. Okay, we have 5 minutes. So questions, yes. Actually, her question was, in a 20-minute exam visit, like the example that I gave, how do I see the technician and the doctor? What roles do I see them playing in that? I believe the whole healthcare team should be doing 80% of that client transaction, and the doctor should only be doing 20%. So let's say, for example, you've got a wellness visit. I believe the front office team can have already done some preparation with regard to client education. When the client made the appointment, they've talked to the client about what our standard recommendations are based on the age of that pet. So some of it's already been discussed before they even come in to the visit. And then when they're put into a room, you have a technician or a veterinary assistant come in, get a thorough history of that patient based on the standardized questions that you've set in your hospital So you have standardized medical history questions based on the symptoms of the patient. So if it's a wellness visit, you have certain questions you ask. If it's an ear infection, you have certain questions you ask. So the technical team goes in and asks those questions, and then they're going to make recommendations based on the standards. So for example, if it's a ear case, they're going to recommend an ear cytology. They're going to recommend maybe an ear mite test or ear mite swab. They're going to talk to the client that they may have to do an ear cytology. An ear culture and sensitivity. That they may need to sedate this pet because his ears are very tender and sore, and they're going to need to clean and flush out those ears and maybe remove some of the hair that's in the ear. Because the technical team already knows what the standard is in the practice, and they've been empowered to communicate that. So they're going to go ahead and get some of those tests already started, and then they're going to come out of this exam room, and they're going to go to the doctor and say, okay, in room one, I have Mrs. Jones with Buffy. I've already done the ear cytology. Here are the results. I've talked to her about possibly sedating the animal, culture and sensitivity. Here's what she's told me about the history of this dog. The doctor goes in, does a thorough exam, and then while the doctor is doing the exam, the technician is listening to what the doctor is saying and anticipating the next steps. So then the doctor says, my technician, Kim, is going to come in and go over the rest of the treatment plan with you and go over the medications with you. And if you have any other questions, I'm happy to come back. Otherwise, it was great seeing you today. And they're done. And they're moving on to the next room. Does that make sense? Okay. Yes. Okay, what she said was, how do you get your clients to comply with the changes of empowering your staff to do more in the exam room when they've gotten so bonded to the doctor and they've gotten so used to the doctor doing these procedures and doing the client education? How do you get the healthcare team involved in that process and the client not freak out over it? And I believe that most clients want a healthy pet. That's the bottom line. They want a healthy pet and they want their problem solved. And what it requires, it is a transition. Here is what has to happen in order for you to be successful in that. Number one, you've got to have a competent healthcare team that acts professional. So that means that technician needs to be able to walk into the exam room and say, hi, Mrs. Jones, I'm Kim. I'm Dr. Smith's technician today, and I'm going to just ask you some questions about Muffy. And it has exudes confidence to the point where the client goes, wow, okay. Because when you think about it, when you go to your human doctor or your dentist, who do you see predominantly? It's the nurse. But yet in veterinary practice, we are still utilizing that utilitarian, agrarian backdrop. Because back in those days, it was all about illness, injury, and disease. And so it needed the intimate contact time of a veterinarian. And today, we're dealing with wellness and routine, common maladies. And it doesn't need 100% contact time of a veterinarian. Also, what has to happen is the veterinarian has to publicly instill confidence in that healthcare team member with the client. So the doctor has to say, my technician Kim is going to be able to go over all of that with you. She's going to be able to answer all of your questions. She's going to go over the treatment plan with you. And the veterinarian has to instill that confidence in the healthcare team members. And I've seen this happen. I saw my father's practice transform. He was doing everything himself, and over a period of time, we started developing our team, we started empowering them, and now the healthcare team members educate clients, and they do all the things that I just mentioned earlier. But it is a process. You can't have healthcare team members do those tasks if they're not ready. And it requires setting those standards in place. They need to be able to communicate in a way that exudes confidence, give good eye contact, shake the client's hand, use the client's name when they talk to the client. Have positive body language. Wear a uniform that's professional. Be able to communicate in a way that the client is confident in what they're saying. And so that takes training. And I'm going to talk about training in the next couple of sessions, and how to develop your people to a point where you can empower them to do those things. Someone else over here. Her question was, how many times should you go over a protocol with a healthcare team member before they get it? you know, they go over it and they go over it and they seem not to be getting it. And I think that's where accountability comes in. I think there's two issues. Do you have the right people on your team? You know, yesterday I talked about recruiting the right people every time, and I think we sometimes do not hire the right people for our team. We need, if we're going to empower our healthcare team, we need to be able to hire bright, educated employees who have a propensity to serve clients, that enjoy communicating, enjoy talking to clients. And then once you put those protocols in place, you test them. And the testing is based on whether they're going to stay in the position or not. So there's some accountability there. If they can't learn their job, then they don't need to be in the job. And I think so many times they get away with, you know, because we don't hold them accountable for the things we've implemented. And we said, you know, this is the way we're going to do it. And they don't do it, and we don't hold them accountable to it, so they say, well, I guess it's no big deal that I didn't do it the way they said I had to, and so I'm not going to worry about it. Yes, I do. I have several suggestions. How many of you have called your insurance agent or any customer service department, and before you get on the call with the rep, there's a recording that says, this call may be monitored for quality assurance? Start monitoring your phones. Or have you gone and taken your car in to the dealership to get serviced or repaired? And at the desk, they will say to you, now, Ms. Dowdy, you're going to get a phone call from a third-party customer marketing, and they're going to ask you questions about the level of service we provided. Now, I'm really hoping you're going to give us an exceptional rating, but is there anything we could have done differently that we could do now to make sure that happens? And then you get a phone call. And they go through, you know, they ask 10 or 15 questions about the level of service that you received when you were in their place of business. Why not implement those types of things in your practice? Have employees actually, you know, one day a week call clients that came into your practice and ask those questions. Mrs. Jones, when you came in for your wellness visit last Monday, were you asked, Did they discuss dentistry with you? Did they discuss heartworm preventative with you? Did they go over these things with you? Was the receptionist polite and friendly when you walked in the door? Did you get greeted with eye contact and a smile? And you just go through those things, and then when you start holding your team accountable, now they start to realize that you mean business. This is serious. This is part of their job description to do these things. All right, thank you all so much. I hope you come back. We're going to talk more about setting these standards and training everyone to the standards.